Hi, Dave Emery here. This is For the Record program number 992. Hindutva Fascism, Part 5, Political and Historical Context, subtitled Connecting the Dots. This is being recorded on January 17th of the year 2018. As indicated by the program title, we're going to resume our discussion and, at least for the time being, sum up and contextualize our discussion of Hindutva fascism, that is H-I-N-D-U-T-V-A, or Hindu nationalist fascism. We have been speaking about the RSS, for which Narendra Modi's BJP is a political front. That is a Hindutva fascist organization, one of whose members, a former secretary of V.D. Savarkar, about whom we will hear more, murdered Mahatma Gandhi. Indeed, the RSS, when the closely allied Hindu Mahasabha, as we saw in For the Record 988 and 989, were the driving forces behind the murder of Mahatma Gandhi, and it has been covered up. We then looked in For the Record 990 at the suppression of free speech, the violent interdiction of journalistic and political critics of Narendra Modi, and the effects this has had on Indian society. Many of the things that we have been seeing with Modi are not unfamiliar to an American audience. The apparent tampering of voting machines, the manipulation of the Dalit or untouchable caste, the lowest rung on the Indian socioeconomic ladder, the attempts to mobilize them on behalf of Narendra Modi's economic neoliberal agenda, a neoliberal agenda that focuses popular attention and ire on the Muslim minority in India. In our last program, we took a look at a particular manifestation of Hindutva fascism, namely the Hare Krishna cult, one of whose members, Tulsi Gabbard, someone we will have more to say about in this program, was not only Bernie Sanders' prospective vice presidential candidate, she placed his name in nomination at the Democratic National Convention. She also was networking with Narendra Modi and his BJP and the Hindutva Fascist RSS in India. It was Tulsi Gabbard who helped to arrange some of the details of Narendra Modi's U.S. visit. In this program, we are going to look, as the title indicates, at how Hindutva fascism networks with and how it could be seen as a tile in some larger political and historical mosaics. We're going to take a look again at how the RSS has networked with and admired both Italian fascism under Mussolini and German Nazism under Hitler, in addition to opposing having India merely as a colony of Britain. The RSS under Savarkar proposed that India and Britain would become part of an Aryan empire. It was sort of a proposal to have India become an equal, albeit Asian, component of a larger British slash Indian Aryan empire. Generally, many of the fascist movements that got going in the Third World did have anti-colonialism as a foundational element. That is true of Subhas Chandra Bose's Indian National Army that we will talk about. It was true of many of the RSS, even though Savarkar ideally saw India and in Britain as part of a, quote, Aryan empire. The desire to free themselves from either British or, in some cases, French or Russian / Soviet domination spurred many of the Third World fascist movements. In this program, we're going to take a look at networking, both operationally and ideologically, between the RSS and Hitler and Mussolini, and some of the components of that. There were ideological reasons as well as practical, sort of hands-on anti-colonial reasons. Both Hitler and Mussolini were idealized by members of the RSS. They saw them as people who had provided a conservative revolution that benefited their countries, and they sought something similar for India. Also, Nazism in particular hearkened to a mythological, quote, Aryan, unquote, past that has a great deal of overlap with some of the Hindutva political mythology as well. We're going to look at that. Then we are going to take a look at Savitri Devi, about whom we spoke briefly in our last program, and about whom we spoke at considerable length in For the Record 172. Originally a Greek woman, she became a convert to Nazism and spent much of her life attempting to solidify the link between Nazism and Hinduism in India. Her mystical, sort of esoteric Nazism has had an appeal with many of the post-war Nazi members of the Fascist International, and indeed many contemporary, quote, alt-right, unquote, spokespersons and writers have hearkened back to Savitri Devi and beyond that to the Nazi / Hindu Aryan ideology / mythology in the contemporary period as well. People like Curtis Yarvin, or Mencius Moldbug as he is called, people like Peter Thiel, very close to Donald Trump and mentioned by the press as a possible candidate to head up the president's intelligence advisory board, is a devotee of Oswald Spengler's Decline of the West and of Carl Schmitt, one of the arguably the top Nazi legal theoretician. And before he actually joined with the Reich, he was a dominant force in the German Conservative Revolution, or Conservative Revolution. People like Yarvin, a.k.a. Moldbug, people like Peter Thiel, are associated with what some have termed the Dark Enlightenment. They view the Enlightenment as undesirable, and they saw it as helping to bring about the Kali Yuga, an age of degeneration. And both the RSS, contemporary fascist elements, some of the elements associated with the Hare Krishna cult, all see the contemporary period as the Kali Yuga and see Hitler and related elements, including elements of the Hindutva fascist movement, as the antidote to that. In addition to looking at Hindutva fascism as part of what both freelance Danish journalist Henrik Kruger in his book The Great Heroin Coup and Kevin Coogan, the author of Dreamer of the Day, Francis Parker Yockey and the Post-War Fascist International, have termed the international, the fascist international, or what Kruger called international fascista. We are then going to, after doing that, we're going to take a look at how Narendra Modi and his neoliberal economic agenda appealed to people like Pierre Omidyar, the financial angel of First Look Media and The Intercept. He is the political or the financial sugar daddy to people like Glenn Greenwald, joined at the hip with WikiLeaks, well known for his work getting a hold of the NSA files from Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, and like Snowden, like Julian Assange, also involved with the Snowden gambit. They are advocates of libertarian, extreme libertarian political philosophy. That dovetails nicely with Mussolini's corporate state. If you remove government regulation, then the power and the decision-making will reside with powerful corporations, and anything that gets in their way, be damned. Both Narendra Modi and the OUND successor fascists in the Ukraine have received support from Pierre Omidyar. The Omidyar Network, his philanthropic network. And if we look at both Ukraine and India, they are both on two different sides of much of the Earth Island. Ukraine flanks Russia in the east, and India is to the south and the southwestern flank of China. In military affairs, a flanking maneuver is the most basic maneuver, and in a sense, we could be looking at the elevation of fascists in Ukraine and also in India as part of a geopolitical flanking maneuver against both China and Russia on what geopoliticians have termed the Earth Island or the World Island, the stretch of land going from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way across Europe, most of the Middle East, Russia, China, and India. Geopoliticians have seen dominance of that that stretch of land, which contains most of the world's land mass, most of the world's population, most of the world's natural resources. Geopoliticians have seen domination of that as the key to world domination. In the contemporary period, with both Russia and China under fire to a considerable extent from the U.S. and, in Russia's case, from Europe as well, Germany in particular, the elevation of fascism in Ukraine with Pravi Sektor, the Azov Battalion, Svoboda, and related elements, and in India with Narendra Modi, the BJP, and the RSS, with the assistance, apparently, of people from Hare Krishna in some cases, that could be seen against the background of tension between Russia and the West and China and the West. One could see, and I suspect that is the case, the elevation of various manifestations of political fascism, in turn encapsulating neoliberal free market libertarian socioeconomic doctrine. I don't think that's an accident, and I think we can see Pierre Omidyar's neoliberal philosophy and his active support for the elevation of the Maidan government in Ukraine and Narendra Modi's team in India as part of the same operation. We're going to take a look at, we're going to review how Modi, Mr. Wonderful, who's going to bring freedom to everybody as part of his neoliberal agenda, is moving to weaken India's child labor laws. At the same time, Silicon Valley has been oozing all over Narendra Modi, seeking to ramp up their sales in the world's second most populous country. India ranks just behind China. We're going to take a look, too, at the support for Narendra Modi and the BJP from people like Steve Bannon, and the networking that BJP people have done with Donald Trump. We're going to look at Bannon's admiration for and Trump's apparent consideration for a cabinet position of the aforementioned Tulsi Gabbard. We're going to take a look at how a Omidyar-financed publication covered for Tulsi Gabbard. And we're going to take a look, too, at Tulsi Gabbard adding her name to a long list of co-sponsors of a bill that would basically label anyone opposing Ukraine's entry into the EU as a terrorist. Well, that's an interesting definition of a terrorist.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. Long article-length descriptions of the For the Record programs are available at spitfirelist.com, also featuring information that wasn't in the original program due to the limitations of time.
Now, plunging right in, we're going to review most of an article from the International Business Times of March 6th of 2012. It's by Palash, P-A-L-A-S-H, R. Ghosh, G-H-O-S-H. Hindu Nationalists, Historical Links to Fascism and Nazism. Skipping down. The current BJP is a successor of the Bharatiya Jana Sangh, or BJS party, which itself was the political arm of the Rashtriya Swayamsevak Sangh, or RSS, a group that espoused openly militant Hindu activism and the suppression of minorities in India. What may surprise many in the West is that some of the most prominent figures of RSS deeply admired fascism and Nazism, the two totalitarian movements that swept through Europe at the time. In the decades prior to the assassination of Gandhi, senior RSS members had direct links to both Benito Mussolini in Italy and Adolf Hitler in Germany. Part of the RSS's fascination with these totalitarian regimes was their shared opposition to the British Empire. However, it went far beyond that. The RSS, as well as multitudes of other Hindu nationalists, admired the way Mussolini and Hitler reorganized their respective nations so quickly from the wreckage of war to build a powerful economy and military under the banner of patriotism and nationalism. With respect to Hitler and Nazism, the links to India and Hinduism were even deeper and more profound than those with Mussolini's Italy. Much of Nazi ideology and imagery came from the symbols and history of ancient India. Indeed, the infamous Nazi swastika was based on a Hindu symbol of strength and good fortune. Moreover, the legendary history, some would say myth, of the invasion of prehistoric India by the mysterious, quote, Aryan, unquote, tribes would, centuries later, provide Hitler with his notion of a super master race that was destined to dominate the world. During World War II, some Indian nationalists received explicit support from German Nazis. In fact, some Indian soldiers even served in Hitler's armies and in the notorious SS. Marzia, M-A-R-Z-I-A, Casolari, capital C-A-S-O-L-A-R-I, an Italian scholar who studied Indian politics, once wrote of RSS's connections with European fascism. The existence of direct contacts between the representatives of the Italian fascist regime, including Mussolini, and Hindu nationalists demonstrates that Hindu nationalism had much more than an abstract interest in the ideology and practice of fascism. The interest of Indian Hindu nationalists in fascism and Mussolini must not be considered as dictated by an occasional curiosity confined to a few individuals. Rather, it should be considered as the culminating result of the attention that Hindu nationalists focused on Italian dictatorship and its leader. To them, fascism appeared to be an example of a successful conservative revolution. Perhaps there was no greater admirer of Hitler and Mussolini in India than Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, or V.D. Savarkar, another leading member of the RSS. He was actually the most important member of the RSS. Hejowar visited him and formed the RSS specifically as a political cadre to put into effect the ideology developed by V.D. Savarkar. Natarajan Godse, who killed Gandhi, was Savarkar's personal secretary, as we saw in For the Record 988. And Savarkar was the driving force behind the killing of Mahatma Gandhi, as we saw again in For the Record 988 and For the Record 989. So resuming with our last and repeating our last sentence about Savarkar, again, the architect of the killing of Gandhi. Perhaps there was no greater admirer of Hitler and Mussolini in India than Vinayak Damodar Savarkar, another leading member of the RSS. In a speech delivered in 1940 after the Second World War had commenced, Savarkar said, "There is no reason to suppose that Hitler must be a human monster because he passes off as a Nazi, or that Churchill is necessarily a demigod because he calls himself a Democrat. Nazism proved undeniably to be the savior of Germany under the set of circumstances that Germany had been placed in." And after discussing Savarkar's criticism of Nehru for his appointment, opposition, I should say, to fascism, and supplementing that, Savarkar said of Nehru, "Surely Hitler knows better than Pandit Nehru does what suits Germany best. The very fact that Germany or Italy has so wonderfully recovered and grown so powerful as never before at the touch of Nazi or fascist magical wand is enough to prove that those political isms were the most congenial tonics their health demanded." Indeed, many Hindu nationalists also derided Gandhi for opposing Nazism and fascism. In 1939, a spokesman for the Hindu Mahasabha intimately connected Germany with Indian culture and people. By the way, the Hindu Mahasabha, along with the RSS, was the paramilitary cadre that had infiltrated, deeply infiltrated, the Indian national security and police establishments, as well as the political establishment, and helped to effect the cover-up of the murder of Mahatma Gandhi. Of the Hindu Mahasabha's view of Nazism, Germany's solemn idea of the revival of the Aryan culture, the glorification of the swastika, her patronage of Vedic learning, and the ardent championship of the tradition of Indo-Germanic civilization are welcomed by the religious and sensible Hindus of India with a jubilant hope, the Mahasabha spokesman blustered. Only a few socialists, headed by Nehru, had created a bubble of resentment against the present government of Germany, but their activities are far from having any significance in India, unquote. He added, "Germany's crusade against the enemies of Aryan culture will bring all the Aryan nations of the world to their senses and awaken the Indian Hindus for the restoration of their lost glory." In 1938, during a time of accelerating anti-Jewish legislation in Germany, Savarkar suggested a similar fate for India's Muslim minority. "A nation is formed by a majority living therein," he declared. What did the Jews do in Germany? They, being in minority, were driven out from Germany. Unquote. Another senior RSS member, Madhav Sadashiv Golwalkar, also praised Nazism and believed the ideology should be applied to India. "German race pride has now become the topic of the day," he wrote. "To keep up the purity of the race and its culture, Germany shocked the world by purging her country of the Semitic races, the Jews. Race pride at its highest has been manifested here. Germany has also shown how well nigh impossible it is for races and cultures having differences going to the root to be assimilated into one united whole. A good lesson for us in Hindustan," parenthetically India, "to learn and profit by." Golwalkar enthusiastically advocated for an India dominated by Hindus. There are only two courses open to the foreign elements, either to merge themselves in the national race and adopt its culture, or to live at its mercy so long as the national race may allow them to do so, and to quit the country at the sweet will of the national race, he wrote. Again, quoting, "That is the only sound view on the minorities problem. That is the only logical and correct solution. That alone keeps the national life healthy and undisturbed. The foreign races in Hindustan, parenthetically India, must either adopt the Hindu culture and language, must learn to respect and hold in reverence Hindu religion, must entertain no idea but those of the glorification of the Hindu race and culture, i.e. of the Hindu nation, and must lose their separate existence to merge in the Hindu race, or they may stay in the country wholly subordinated to the Hindu nation, claiming nothing, deserving no privileges, far less any preferential treatment, not even the rights of a citizen." If one were to replace Hindu with German, Goldwater's words would match Hitler's rhetoric almost exactly. Savarkar also spelled out why Hindus should rule India and others should either be expelled or merge into the Hindu majority. "The Aryans who settled in India at the dawn of history already formed a nation, now embodied in the Hindus," he wrote. Again, quoting Savarkar, "Hindus are bound together not only by the love they bear to a common fatherland and by the common blood that courses through their veins and keeps our hearts throbbing and our affection warm, but also by the common homage we pay to our great civilization, our Hindu culture." And again, I don't think it requires any imagination at all to speak up to see how that dovetails with Nazism. In past discussions, including in For the Record 172, we have spoken about Subhas Chandra Bose and the Indian National Legion. That was a body of Indian nationals, many of them composed of prisoners of war who had been captured fighting for the British in Europe. And they were formed into an Axis unit that fought in Europe and eventually was absorbed late in the war into the Waffen-SS. Ultimately, it found sponsorship by the Japanese as well. From the Wikipedia entry on the Indian Legion, "The Indian Legion, or Indische Legion, officially the Free India Legion, or Infantry Regiment 950 Indian, and later the Indian Volunteer Legion of the Waffen-SS. Indische Freiwillige Legion der Waffen-SS was a military unit raised during the Second World War in Nazi Germany. Intended to serve as a liberation force for British-ruled India in its inception, it was made up of Indian prisoners of war and expatriates in Europe. Because of its origins in the Indian independence movement, it was known as the Tiger Legion and the Azad Hind Fauj. Originally raised as part of the German army, it became part of the Waffen-SS in August of 1944. You can actually find pictures of some of the Indians who served in the Indian Legion and after its incorporation into the Waffen-SS online.
You're listening to Dave Emery's For the Record. You can subscribe to the comments posted on the SpitfireList.com website, most of them by a brilliant contributing editor who uses the moniker Terra Fractal, specializing, but by no means exclusively, in economic and financial matters.
Now, dovetailing the Nazi Hindu, quote, Aryan philosophy with some of the elements that we see on the alt-right, bearing in mind that, as we have looked at in the past, Donald Trump and some of Donald Trump's Indian business partners are associated with the BJP. Steve Bannon, before falling from power, viewed Narendra Modi as the Ronald Reagan of India. He also was an admirer of Tulsi Gabbard, and reportedly Tulsi Gabbard was being considered for a cabinet appointment in the Trump administration. The, quote, alt-right, the term I hate, but it is in popular usage. They view elements of the Hindu Nazi philosophy with great favor. From BBC Magazine of October 29th of 2017, an article by Maria Margaronis, M-A-R-I-A-M-A-R-G-A-R-O-N-I-S, Savitri, S-A-V-I-T-R-I, Devi, D-E-V-I, the mystical fascist being resurrected by the alt-right. And further developing the Nazi-Hindu ideological or philosophical or perhaps mythical overlap, this article goes into that and its appeal for the, quote, alt-right. Savitri Devi, a mystical admirer of Hitler and a cat-loving devotee of the Aryan myth, seemed destined to fade into obscurity after her death 25 years ago. But thanks to the rise of the extreme right, her name and her image now crop up online more and more. In 2012, browsing the website of Greece's Golden Dawn Party for an article I was writing, I stumbled on a picture of a woman in a blue silk sari gazing at a bust of Hitler against a blazing sunset sky. What was this apparently Hindu woman doing on the site of an openly racist party devoted to expelling all foreigners from Greece? I filed her as a curiosity in the back of my mind until the rising tide of extreme right politics in Europe and America threw up the name of Savitri Devi once again. Again, the name S-A-V-I-T-R-I-D-E-V-I. It isn't hard these days to find discussions of Savitri Devi's books on neo-Nazi web forums, especially her work The Lightning and the Sun, which expounds the theory that Hitler was an avatar, an incarnation of the Hindu god Vishnu, and gold in the furnace, which urges true believers to trust that National Socialism will rise again. The American extreme right website Countercurrents hosts an extensive online archive of her life and work. Her views are reaching a wider public, too, thanks to American alt-right leaders such as Richard Spencer and Steve Bannon, former Trump chief strategist and the former chair of Breitbart News, who have taken up the account of history as a cyclical battle between good and evil, a theory she shared with other 20th century mystical fascists. Dark metal bands and American right-wing radio stations also roar about the Kali Yuga, the dark age of Hindu mythology, which Savitri Devi believed that Hitler was once destined to bring to an end. Who was Savitri Devi, and why are her ideas being resurrected now? Despite the sari and the name, she was a European, born Maximiani, M-A-X-I-M-I-A-N-I, Portas, capital P-O-R-T-A-S as in Sam, to an English mother and a Greek-Italian father in Lyon in 1905. Skipping down, she blamed the Western allies for Greece's humiliation and for what she saw as the unjustly punitive terms imposed on Germany by the Treaty of Versailles. In Savitri's mind, Greece and Germany were both victims, denied the legitimate aspiration of uniting all their people in one territory. That view, combined with a passionate anti-Semitism which she claimed she learned from the Bible, led her to identify herself early on as a National Socialist. Hitler was Germany's champion, but she said his desire to eradicate Europe's Jews and restore the, quote, Aryan race, unquote, to its rightful position of power made him her Führer as well. In common with anti-Semitic thinkers since the 18th century, Savitri blamed Judeo-Christianity for destroying the glory that was Greece and the Aryans' mythical ancient utopia. In the early 1930s, she sailed for India in search of a living version of Europe's pagan past, convinced that the caste system, by forbidding intermarriage, had preserved pure Aryans in India. Former Ku Klux Klan leader David Duke, who visited India in the 1970s, shared her misconception. So unusual was the sight of a European woman traveling fourth class by train that she was placed under surveillance by the British colonial authorities. But Savitri had little to do with the British in India until World War II, when she passed information she gleaned from them to the Japanese. She learned Indian languages, married a Brahmin whom she believed to be an Aryan like herself, and forged an elaborate synthesis of Nazism and Hindu myth in which Hitler was, quote, a man against time, unquote, destined to bring about the end of the Kali Yuga and usher in a new golden age of Aryan supremacy. And then the book, goes on to further develop her views in that regard. She was by no means alone, and indeed in For the Record 991, we took a look at how the philosophy of Swami Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada dovetails very effectively with the Hindu Nazi political ideology / philosophy. Skipping down again, in this BBC magazine article about Savitri Devi. In her book, A Warning to the Hindus, which came out in 1939, she advised the Hindus to cultivate a spirit of organized resistance throughout Hinduism, Sumanta Banerjee says. The target of this resistance were the Muslims, who were a threat, according to her, to the Hindus. And this is the same fear that is being echoed in India today. Hindutva, or Hindu nationalism, as we have seen, is the official ideology of Prime Minister Narendra Modi's ruling BJP, which claims that Muslims and secularists have undermined the strength of the Hindu nation. Though the party's official spokesman condemned violence, the raids that led to the tearing down of the Babri Mosque at Ayodhya in 1992, and the current waves of attacks, sometimes fatal, by vigilante groups on Muslims and dissenters, tell a different story. In the U.S., racism, anti-communism, and Christian fundamentalist notions about the impending apocalypse have together prepared the ground for the far-right's flirtation with occult Nazism and Hindu prophecies. And as in India, the traditional ruling majority's fear of losing power has been an effective recruiting tool. Savitri Devi's work forms part of the history of both India's Hindu nationalists and the European and American extreme right. Her flamboyant, eccentric writings contain unvarnished and uncensored all their key ideas, that human beings can be divided into races, unquote, which should be kept separate, that certain groups are superior to and more entitled than others, that these groups are under threat, and that the dark times in which we live will only end when they again take power, returning us to a mythical golden age. Both in terms of the mystical Hindu, Nazi, Aryan myth, and of course, again, the admiration for Hitler and Mussolini as effective, strong leaders, that helped to endear European fascism to Hindutva fascists and the RSS in particular. And that is one of the things, as we have seen, that fed the attention or the affection of the alt-right for people like Savitri Devi and the Hindu-Nazi-Aryan philosophy. Both Narendra Modi's rise in India and the rise of the OUNB fascists in Ukraine were assisted by Pierre Omidyar, the main fellow in eBay, and the fellow who has financed the efforts of Glenn Greenwald, First Look Media, and The Intercept, and who has proved to be the repository for the purloined NSA files. As we have seen in For the Record 889, Pierre Omidyar is a devotee of the Austrian School of Economics, people like Ludwig von Mises and Friedrich Hayek, also the apple of the economic ideological eye of people like Julian Assange, Edward Snowden, the Koch brothers, and also Glenn Greenwald and Pierre Omidyar, his financial journalistic angel as well. We've also seen how Pierre Omidyar collaborated with the Rural Development Institute, or Landesa, in India. That is an extension of the Phoenix program in Vietnam. And we have also seen how Omidyar, again in For the Record 889, has worked with the National Endowment for Democracy and the Agency for International Development and the Ford Foundation, all heavily intersected with U.S. intelligence in elevating the Maidan OUNB successor organizations in Ukraine. There is a recent book, The CIA is Organized Crime, by Douglas Valentine, published in soft cover by Clarity Press. A fair amount of the book is interviews that Douglas Valentine, best known as the author of a seminal work about the Phoenix program in Vietnam, of which the RBI was part. He discusses a little bit about Omidyar's background and reasons for this collaboration. In an interview with radio host Ryan Dawson. Valentine, the Center UA is the organization that Pierre Omidyar co-funded 2 years ago. Center UA is an umbrella organization that is linked to various activist projects and NGOs, one of which is the New Citizen Campaign, which, according to the Financial Times, played a big role in getting the protests up and running at the Maidan. Skipping down, why did Omidyar prove willing to come on board with such known regime change sponsors as USAID and NED, to say nothing of George Soros? Where else is he cooperating? It should never be forgotten that this is the kind of company he keeps. And then discussing Omidyar's background and how that suggests that his family may have actually been involved with U.S. intelligence monitoring of Russia in Iran. Omidyar is originally, his family are from Iran. Skipping down, Valentine comments, maybe Pierre Omidyar is accessible to U.S. foreign policy agencies due to some prior family connection. Maybe that accounts for why he spent a few hundred thousand dollars, a paltry sum for a billionaire, to help put the Central UA in place in Ukraine, so the CIA could run operations against the Russians like it did out of Iran. I've never heard any explanation from inquisitive Glenn Greenwald. When it comes to his sugar daddy's monkey business, Greenwald's policy is pure see no, hear no, speak no evil. Why? Is that the quid pro quo for the handout? What I do know is that billionaires like Omidyar and George Soros and the Rockefellers, to say nothing of USAID and NED, aren't funding political action out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing it to advance their interests. That's why an organization like Center UA is created, to advance the interests of its financial backers. To me, it looks like a CIA-facilitated mechanism to create a crisis in Ukraine and exploit it. The 40 NGOs it coordinates are perfectly placed to provide cover for covert CIA political action. And again, there are links to, among other programs, For the Record 889, which detail the collaboration between OMIBR, MAMED, AID, and the elevation of the Maidan regime in Ukraine, featuring those OUMB successor organizations and individuals that I speak about so often, and also OMIBR's strong assistance to the rise of Narendra Modi and the BJP in India. A place, by the way, within the OMIBR network's philanthropic efforts have wrought havoc. So again, as Valentine has suggested, both in Ukraine and in Silicon Valley, people of the neoliberal economic philosophy, and OMIBR has that, sharing it with people like the Koch brothers and Eddie the Friendly Spook Snowden, Julian Assange, people who you would not maybe, or certainly people whom the so-called progressive sector has lionized, not taking note of the fact that people like Snowden, Julian Assange, their political idol, Ron Paul, are as far to the right as you can get. They are anarcho-capitalist philosophers who basically see a total libertarian regime, one that has no rules, as the ideal state of affairs. And much of the success that Donald Trump has enjoyed with the Republican Party is the fact that by appointing people like Scott Pruitt to head up the EPA and other managers of federal agencies whose lifelong goal has been to dismantle those very federal agencies, that plus Trump's giving of the military everything they want, that has basically endeared him to the Republican political milieu. Even though they are critical of his vulgarity and erraticism, he has embodied the neoliberal economic philosophy to a T. I'm not going to go into it in detail, but the New York Times of September 27th of 2015 had an article by Vindu Goel, G-O-E-L, Narendra Modi, Indian Prime Premier, courts Silicon Valley to try and ease nation's poverty. Narendra Modi and Mark Zuckerberg have much in common. And then it talks about how they see themselves as global leaders pushing forward for broad change, blah, 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 blah. On Sunday, the two men engaged in a mutual admiration session at Facebook's Silicon Valley headquarters, with Mr. Modi fielding pre-selected questions from a crowd of Facebook employees and guests invited by the Indian embassy. I wonder if Tulsi Gabbard may have had something to do with this. At the same time as the Silicon Valley crowd and Mark Zuckerberg are oozing all over Narendra Modi, Modi is doing things like this. From the Quartz blog of May 4th of 2015 by Rashmi Sehgal, S-E-H-G-A-L, the Modi government is sending millions of kids back into exploitative labor. What it is about in the article is reprinted in the written description to the show. Modi is weakening India's child labor laws. Now, talking about Tulsi Gabbard. Again, Tulsi Gabbard was Bernie Sanders' prospective vice presidential candidate choice. She placed his name into nomination at the Democratic Convention. I suspect she was former deputy chair of the DNC and then resigned to campaign for Bernie Sanders. I wonder if perhaps she was the source of the flash drive that Craig Murray, former UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, said was the actual source of the DNC emails and not a Russian hack. Pierre OMIBR in his wiki, from Pierre OMIBR's Wikipedia entry, in 2010, OMIBR launched online an investigative reporting news service, Honolulu Civil Beat, covering civic affairs in Hawaii. On September 4th, 2013, Honolulu Civil Beat started a partnership with the Huffington Post, launching the weblog's latest regional edition, HuffPost Hawaii. Now, the Omega sponsorship of Honolulu Civil Beat is something I find interesting because in an article about Tulsi Gabbard, who is a member of a branch of the Hare Krishna cult headed up by a guy named Chris Butler or Jagad Guru Siddhartha Pananda Paramahansa. I'm not going to spell it for you. You can read it in the description. The article was called Tulsi Gabbard Still Dogged by Krishna Cult Rumors. It's by Rule R-U-L Kaneya, K-A-N-E-Y-A, from the Huffington Post of March 16th of 2015. And it says, now Tulsi Gabbard is a member of the cult. Her parents are members of the cult that we talked about in For the Record 991. Her husband, her in-laws, and most importantly, her congressional staff are taken from Chris Butler's branch of the Hare Krishna cult. And yet, the Omidyar-sponsored Honolulu Civil Beat says, Civil Beat found no evidence that Tulsi Gabbard is or ever was a Butler devotee, and we could find no record of her speaking publicly about that. Now, that is very interesting because on the very website that they talk about here, there is the following video, the audio track of which we're going to review right now. This is Tulsi Gabbard talking about Swami Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada, the head guru of the Hare Krishna cult, whose ripe political philosophy we went into last week.
Namaste, Jai Shri Krishna. When I was invited to join all of you on this most auspicious celebration, I was immediately overcome by feelings of both humility and great joy. I'm blessed and honored to have this opportunity, and I want to thank you from the core of my heart. Although my attempts to offer praise to my beloved grandfather spiritual master, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, can be likened to a child offering a small torchlight to the sun, out of his kindness, Lord Krishna beckons me to do so for my own edification. Throughout my life, I, like so many of you, have been faced with stressful, challenging, or fearful situations. But in all these situations, I've had the great fortune of being able to find solace, inner peace, and spiritual happiness by taking shelter in the holy names of Krishna. Indeed, simply by uttering Jai Shri Krishna, my lips taste sweetness beyond compare, and my heart leaps for joy. But the fact is, if not for the compassion of His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, I never would have achieved this supreme treasure of Krishna's holy names. Srila Rupa Goswami says, a person who is unable to bear another's distress is called compassionate. It was this compassion that drove Srila Prabhupada to attempt something so brave and so daring to deliver the message of Lord Chaitanya and the holy name to all of mankind. We get a glimpse of the compassion that Srila Prabhupada felt for all of us in a poem which he wrote in honor of his spiritual master, His Divine Grace Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada. He wrote, the jivas have reshackled themselves with the heavy chains of ignorance and delusion, and as they swim about in the vast ocean of material existence, in a frenzied attempt to reach the shore of peace, they perish. This lance of misery pierces my heart, as it similarly afflicted you, Srila Prabhupada, who suffered so upon seeing the suffering of the misguided humanity. Out of this compassionate desire to help us cross the ocean of material suffering, Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami embarked upon a long and difficult voyage across the Indian and Atlantic oceans. He was already advanced in age and in relatively poor health, yet his compassion drove him to commence the journey anyway. While on this journey, he suffered two heart attacks, all the while taking shelter in his spiritual master and Lord Krishna. Those of us who are the spiritual children and grandchildren of His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, would all be lost orphans were it not for His compassion and mercy. My Gurudev, Srila Siddhasirupananda Paramahamsa, has said that while we will never be able to repay the debt of gratitude that we all owe Srila Prabhupada, what we can do is be pleasing to Him by always taking shelter in the holy names of Krishna. By taking shelter in the names of Krishna, we too may become lovers of Krishna, whose lives are motivated by compassion and love for others. My dear friends, in this way, with the sweet names of Krishna always upon our lips and in our hearts, we will always be able to transmit the transcendental nature and glories of Srila Prabhupada's journey to the United States of America and the Western world. So on this historic and auspicious day, we should take this opportunity to beg for the blessing of Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada, so that we too can taste the nectar of love for Krishna and be motivated by compassion to use our lives working for the spiritual and material well-being of others. Again, I thank you all for this opportunity. Jai Shri Krishna, Jai Srila Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada.
And again, that was Miss Congeniality herself, Tulsi Gabbard, talking about Swami Bhaktivedanta Prabhupada. And at about 3:45, she says, in no uncertain terms, that Chris Butler, under his Hindu name, Jagadguru, and so forth, is her guru. So why couldn't Mr. Kaneya, or Rule Kaneya of the Honolulu Civil Beat, find such a pronunciation, or a public pronouncement? It is right there. I think that raises some interesting questions about the Omidyar network, or Omidyar organization, and its possible links with Tulsi Gabbard. Tulsi Gabbard also was among the many co-sponsors of a congressional resolution condemning people who oppose Ukraine's entry into the EU as, among other things, terrorists, etc. And we're going to conclude with an article from Politico of July 11th of 2017. This is by Ben Schreckinger, or Schreckinger, S-C-H-R-E-C-K-I-N-G-E-R. GOP researcher who sought Clinton emails had alt-right help. And this is about the late Peter W. Smith, who gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal, then allegedly killed himself 10 days later. And he was turning to various people on the alt-right for efforts to dig up Hillary Clinton's emails. And this says, the alt-right activist, the journalist, turned entrepreneur Charles Johnson and his former business partner Pax Dickinson agreed to help Smith's quixotic mission. Smith also reached out to Guccifer 2.0, an alias the U.S. intelligence community has linked to Russian state hackers, and Guccifer 2.0 advised Smith to seek the help of a white nationalist hacker who lives in Ukraine. Charles Johnson of the alt-right also suggested that Smith get in touch with Andrew Arenheimer, a hacker who goes by the alias Weave and has collaborated with Johnson in the past. Andrew Arenheimer is the web architect for the Daily Stormer. He lives in Ukraine, and his name has cropped up in connection with the alleged hacks of the DNC. Was he creating a cyber false flag operation? We do not know. All of this is set forth at greater length in the written description, 2 for the record 992, Hindutva Fascism, Part 5, Political and Historical Context, Connecting the Dots. This concludes that program. It's being recorded on January 17th of the year 2018. I'm Dave Emery. Have fun.